Well, I know this is what you all have been waiting for Dr. Professor Frick to come and give the Barron Lecture, which he is about to do. Spiritual care, how does it work? Dr. Eckhard Frick is a physician. He's also, his specialty is psychosomatic medicine. He's also a psychiatrist and a psychoanalyst. And he's professor at the University of Munich. He is also a Jesuit priest and is a professor at the University of the Jesuit University there in Munich. And he is also, in addition to being a priest, he's a professor of philosophy. And one of the unique aspects about Dr. Frick is that he is. He holds the chair of spiritual care at the University of Munich, which is the first chair of this kind really anywhere in Europe and, to my knowledge, anywhere in the world. He shares this chair with Professor Doctor of Theology Traugott Rosser, and who is also, we're also delighted to have with us today. So I won't continue on here, but just welcome, Dr. Frick. We're so pleased to have you here.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you. It's really touching being introduced by Harald Koenig and being invited to this conference. Since 2010, I share with Traugott Rosser this professorship of spiritual care at the University of Munich. Traugott is a Lutheran pastor and specialist in practical theology, and I'm a psychiatrist, Jungian analyst, and Catholic priest, and as a Jesuit, I live in the tradition of Ignatian spiritual exercises, an experience which started at Martin Luther's time, in the Reformation century. As Luther, Zwingli, and Calvin, Ignatius of Loyola wanted to reform the church, fostering the believer's personal pathway, let's say a kind of individualization of faith, what Calvin calls testimonium interius spiritus sancti, the inner testimony of the Holy Spirit. And in the spiritual exercises, Ignatius proposes a way of meditation and discernment of spirits, as he says, for ayudar las animas, for helping the souls. Our professorship is, however, not theological at all. It belongs to the Interdisciplinary Center of Palliative Medicine, also not limited to palliative care. This is already a first answer to our question. Spiritual care works in a broad sense, in a broad clinical and also anthropological horizon concerning all the fields of biopsychosocial medicine and encompassing the entire life of the human being. I am glad to share with you some of our experiences in this new field, at least new in European healthcare. I shall develop my lecture in 12 points, 12 keywords, and also 12 answers. And it is somehow a shared contribution also of both of us. Let's go to a little bit to history, to another Jesuit, Father Fitzgibbon, who was a chaplain in the 50s and who wrote about the matter of spiritual care of patients. And this is interesting because it brings us back to the linguistic roots of what we call spiritual care today. And he says, when I'm dying, if it's in a hospital, I hope that all concerned are interested in more than my body. I hope the nurse is understanding and sympathetic, that she doesn't bother me too much, but sees to it that a priest is there. So you see here the nurse is calling a priest if it is necessary at the end of the life, and it's getting clearer still. About the nurse, where lack of knowledge of or alertness in her part may mean the loss of a soul. If a nursing practice procedure is mishandled, the worst can happen is that the patient dies. If a spiritual care procedure is missed, it can mean the eternal death of the soul. Hence, neglect of thorough instruction of the nurse in spiritual care procedures by those in authority is no less than criminal. This is very strict. I think we have a little bit more belief in God's mercy today, but what is true is that we all need spiritual care training in all the health professions. Father Fitzgibbon gives this small vademecum to all his nurses. They have it with them the whole day. In case of urgency, of emergency, spiritual emergency, they can react. Now, what we think is that every health professional needs a kind of basic spiritual care competency, and that there are specialized competencies of different professions and also persons. Spiritual care is the shared responsibility of physicians, nurses, psychotherapists, and chaplains, and other healthcare professionals. Spiritual care takes into account the patient's needs, options, resources, but also civil rights. For instance, the right to be a spiritual person, also in the public hospital. Spiritual care consists, first of all, of this basic competency of all healthcare professionals. For instance, we heard about it in your lecture about taking a spiritual history. But also in specialized competencies, for instance, the nurse's contact with the fragile body, the nonverbal presence of music therapists, and also specialized psychotherapeutic interventions. Spiritual care is not a burdensome add-on. It encompasses, on the contrary, all what makes a therapeutic relationship spiritual, especially the helper's first-person perspective, my and our spirituality, not only the patient's spirituality. And basically, spiritual care is not a synonym for chaplaincy, for pastoral care. Neither can it be delegated to chaplains. It's really a task for all health professions. We are, according to Charles Taylor, in a secular age, in an age of authenticity. People now want their own experience in this field. I already said that the time of Luther and Ignatius was quite similar to this modern spiritual quest, an individual quest. And spiritual care works through authenticity within the broad field of the spiritualities of today, which encompass different religious traditions, religious belongings, but also crises, conflicts with religious institutions, and even existential, humanistic, atheistic convictions. According to the World Health Organization of the Bangkok Charter, every human being has a spiritual dimension. It's not restricted to believers. Now, this broad definition of spirituality is somehow in contrast with a clear definition making of spiritual care. It provokes ongoing discussions and thorny discourses about a consensus, what is spirituality in medicine. Conceptual vagueness is, however, not only a problem, but also an advantage. The blurring of and vagueness of spirituality definitions are not cleared up by one theoretical concept, which may be dogmatic, theological, or empirical. In fact, the principal validating criterion for spirituality is authenticity in a patient-centered dialogue. Harold Koenig told us a lot about this patient-centered dialogue in spirituality, respecting the limits of our patients. In this figure, you see that unmet spiritual needs may provoke spiritual distress, an increase in physical and emotional symptoms, and then an increase in health service utilization. So it's important also from a financial and economic point of view to take into account spiritual needs. My next key word is spiritual plurality. Spiritual care works in a symphony of different spiritualities. Spiritual quests in the framework of institutionalized religions and also unchurched spiritual searching. In this pluralistic symphony, the patient's or the carer's spirituality may be more or less specific. It may be, for instance, Lutheran, Carmelite, Ignatian, Zen, or Sufi spirituality. So there are many specific spiritualities in the field and this broad concept of spirituality. Let's come to the struggle. Spiritual care, I'm convinced, works in conflict, in discernment, in discourse, not in easily acquired harmony. If there is so-called harmony, this may in fact be a consequence of several things. First of all, of a kind of hidden normativity. One religious tendency tries to impose its spiritual position or their God image, or a non-conflicting acceptance of God will to all the other tendencies. Our colleague, theological colleague Isolde Carle and other critics of spiritual care remind us that the biblical concept, the biblical vision of illness and coping should by no means be reduced to passivity, acceptance, or quietism. On the contrary, complaint, struggle, lamentation, also struggling with God, are characteristic for biblical figures such as Jacob, Rachel, Job, and also Jesus, who does not die in harmony, who cries at the cross. Another point to which may jeopardize this conflicting characteristic of spiritual care is a lack of rationality in this field, of rational discourse. Often spirituality is considered as purely subjective and arbitrary. In his seminar about the Ignatian exercises, Carl Gustav Jung reminds us that the Latin word spiritus, as well as the Greek pneuma, means a soft breath and blowing. Conversely, the German word for spirit is Geist, English ghost. And this word in German indicates passion and fire. It is related to the Germanic word Usgeißeln, to induce an emotional condition, to get someone out of himself, as we Swiss, I quote Carl Gustav Jung, as we say in Swiss German, sich zum Aufgeiste, meaning that a situation or person has become intolerable. This corresponds to the English word aghast. So we have in this smooth and gentle and harmonious spirituality another point of view, which is represented by this Germanic root Geist or ghost, and which is more polemic. Very often, Jung uses the comparison between the Holy Spirit and the alcoholic spirit. And this is my fifth definition or answer. Spiritual care works through sobriety. When he compares the Holy Spirit and the spirit of drunkenness, this comparison does not lead into identification of both, but into discernment of struggling spirits. In a letter to William Griffith Wilson, founder of the AA, Jung inaugurates spiritual care as a principle of the Alcoholic Anonymous movement, writing the following to Wilson. You see, alcohol in Latin is spiritus, and you use the same word for the highest religious experience as well as for the most depraving poison. The helpful formula, therefore, is spiritus contra spiritum. So a discernment of spirits, what is the spirit which is, who is moving me? My sixth point is not aimlessness, it's more purposelessness. I think this is more correct in English, purposelessness. Spiritual care works independently of religion, health research. Certainly, there's growing evidence about associations between religion, spirituality, and health outcomes, such as quantity and quality of life, coping, mental health, and so on. These associations have to be interpreted in suitable causal networks, taking into account the cultural specificities, for instance, between the United States and Europe and different countries in Europe. However, even if religious involvement were completely unrelated to physical health and medical outcomes, however, integrating spirituality into patient care should still be a priority. Because so many medical patients have spiritual needs, spiritual conflicts, or derive comfort from religious beliefs and traditions, this makes a strong argument for training health professionals to assess, respect, and make accommodations for patients' spiritual beliefs and practices. It also emphasizes the importance of having strong pastoral care departments in hospitals to ensure that someone meets the spiritual needs of patients in a way that is sensitive and culturally appropriate. If I understand you well, you want to say that spiritual care has not a foundation in the good empirical results of religious health research. This is a complementary argument, but the principal argument is anthropology of the human being, is that the human being has spiritual needs, crises, options, and so on, which have to be faced and to be respected. So consequently, I say spiritual care works beyond clinical aims. As a matter of course, patients as well as carers, health professionals, want to attain certain goals, curative goals, palliative goals. For instance, improving a given religious coping or clarifying a relationship towards God or another religious figure. However, spiritual care is not about instrumentalizing spirituality in order to achieve health goals. For example, a plethora of studies shows that church going is associated with better health outcomes. If a doctor prescribes church going or other religious activities, as Sloan and colleagues wrote in the New England Journal in a critical manner, or if patients use church going as they use an anti-hypertension drug or an antibiotic or whatever, for obtaining more self-control, they might stop going altogether when they notice that church going does not work as a drug works. That other churchgoers may be in better health, but for me, it's not an efficient drug. So if people use religion for the primary purpose of achieving certain health goals, then this is a misuse of religion for non-religious goals and could ultimately lead to disillusionment and the abandonment of religion. So it may have really a paradoxical effect when spirituality, religion are instrumentalized for attaining health goals. The context. Spiritual care works in a given institutional and legal context. One characteristic is the presence or absence of chaplains and the form of their integration into therapeutic teams, and there are several models for doing this. So you have spiritual care, you may observe it from the outside. For instance, a sociologist may have a look on different social systems, medicine, healthcare, nursing, pastoral care, psychotherapy, and so on. And what I think for the majority of us is much more important is the internal point of view, finding a point of view about spiritual care in my professional role and practice. So this is one example from Switzerland, the CHUV, Centre Hospitalier Universitaire Vaudois, where the chaplain is integrated as board-certified chaplain, sent from the church, from the Reformed Church, and part of the therapeutic team, in this team of geriatrics. The chaplain, in this case, Etienne Rochard, it's he, but it may be a woman also, represents the spiritual dimension of healthcare and the spiritual competency of all health professionals. So he represents not in an exclusive manner in the team. This is one of the dangers of this model. It's what I call the internal delegation of spiritual care, delegation towards the chaplain. He has studied theology, he has time, so he may provide spiritual care and we do the rest. Conversely, what this team in Lausanne wants to make is a good integration in research, in providing services, and also in reflection about spiritual care. Another model is the following. the chaplain is sent to a hospital from churches and other religious institutions. She or he is considered the principal spiritual care provider without being embedded in the therapeutic team. This model protects privacy of the patient-chaplain relationship, no reporting principle, and also the chaplain's independency. It entails, however, the danger of external delegation. So the healthcare system says, this is not our job. We delegate it, we project the whole theme towards the chaplains, towards religious institutions. And a third model, hospitals and public institutions no longer accept chaplains sent from churches and other religious institutions. The type of open secularism in Quebec and other regions, Quebec, the French-speaking, basically French-speaking Canadian province, transforms chaplains into intervenants en soins spirituels, spiritual caregivers, chosen and paid by the hospital and no longer chosen and sent by the churches. According to our vision of spiritual care is an overlap of healthcare professions. So chaplaincy is an important element of it, but also medicine, social work, psychotherapy, nursing, which was the first discipline of health professionals to adopt spiritual care. And I'm glad about our Maltese, where is our Maltese? There is Maltese delegation. There is a whole, I had the pleasure to meet Maltese spiritual care specialists who are basically nurses on this island, on European, southern European country. So spiritual care is an overlap of all those health professions and an overlap of several contexts. So it always starts with my personal history. For instance, my belonging to a religious group, also my difficulties with obedience and so on. And then by training, later on, 20 years later, training, attitude, skills, and knowledge, the three dimensions in medical schools, and it depends on the team, if a team is available, because there are quite a lot of healthcare givers who have to work alone or without the support of a team. And then there's the institution, a public institution, or it may be a private hospital, for instance, a hospital of church or anthroposophic hospital or Buddhist hospital or whatever. And this institution will have also its value orientations. And then there is an ethical and juridical framework. There are limits as far as neutrality is concerned, as far as protection of civic rights are concerned. There may be one excess of making proselytism, maybe abuse of medical power, and the other extreme is neglecting the patient's spiritual demands. So we are between two extremes. I always explain it to our students that they should avoid both extremes, abusing their power. They don't have the right to abuse their medical power for spiritual aims, even for good intentions. But the other extreme is neglecting the patient's right, the patient's options. And of course, there is a linguistic, an interreligious, a social, socio-cultural background in all we do, and this is really interesting to see even in Europe or even in Switzerland how every canton makes the differences. For instance, if I understand well, because I'm a foreigner here, in the canton of Geneva, there is the French system of separation of church and state and a clear cut between both worlds. And in the canton of Vaud, the spiritual dimension of the human being is in the cantonal constitution. This is a big difference of visions of spirituality. Now, the providers. Spiritual care works in a network of competencies. The care providers are chosen according to professional role and training, and also according to the patient's preferences and by team consensus. Spiritual care works through this patient-centered role-taking. In this palliative study, you see that most of the patients choose family or friends as spiritual care providers, then health professionals, and at the third position, chaplains. And some also use God or a higher power as health care provider. This may be difficult for research because the eternal God is young, is old, he has no age, so this category of age is not applicable to him or to her, because God does not have gender as human beings have. In this study, we checked whether our teaching in spirituality with medical students has a certain efficiency and sustainability. This is now routine, and even before we arrived with our professorship, it was already routine. It was fostered by the former professor of palliative medicine, Gian Domenico Borasio, who is now has the chair of palliative medicine in Lausanne. And in this, in our program, students in our medical school have a compulsory seminar and introduction to palliative care, psychosocial aspects, spirituality, and grief. And there is an evaluation before and after, and 1.5 years after. And we find significant improvement in all aspects, and especially as far as spirituality is concerned, in skills and attitude. And we are happy that this effect has a certain sustainability also. Edwards and colleagues asked about the understanding of spirituality and the potential role of spiritual care in end of life and palliative care. And they made this meta study, patient studies and healthcare providers studies in oncology. And they've found that a spirit-to-spirit framework is very important. So they insist on the relational aspect of spiritual care. As in other studies, we find two criteria which are facilitators or barriers to spiritual care. Time and timing, very often, in our seminars we hear, we don't have time for spirituality. So time and timing may be a barrier, but it may be also a facilitator of spiritual care, a friendly spiritual environment, reflection, education, training, willingness are facilitators, vocation, calling, experience, and also awareness of one's own spirituality, team support and assessment and documentation. Vermander and colleagues published a work about the role of general practitioners in spiritual care, and they asked what are the barriers once more and the facilitating factors that GPs experience in assessing the need for spiritual care and in providing spiritual care. This is an important work because it goes beyond the walls of hospitals. It goes to the practice, to the villages and cities. And what are the views of GPs about their role in spiritual care? So in this work, you find important lists about physician factors, patient factors, and contextual factors, which show us how spiritual care comes to the terrain, comes to the practice of GPs. And of course, you find also a lot of barriers measured and regrouped by Vermander and colleagues. Another GP study is from Slord. It's a Dutch study, also about perceived barriers and facilitators in GP communication and palliative care. GP's lack of availability is a major barrier, and also patients and GP's ambivalence to discuss bad prognosis. So in this study, they found that discussing a bad prognosis may be a barrier, or not discussing it better, could be a barrier to spiritual care. And facilitators, GPs are available, initiating discussion about several end-of-life issues and anticipating various scenarios. So this is larger than spiritual care. It's about palliative care in general, but you notice that spiritual care is a major criterion, a major element of this patient, general practitioner-patient dialogue. At patient level, there are barriers and facilitators related to various topics. Barriers, it's the unwillingness to talk about spiritual issues or about euthanasia. And the only facilitator from the patient's perspective related to topics was a patient's belief in the afterlife. So a certain idea about what is beyond death aids or fosters the patient GP dialogue. At the GP level, the barriers consist of not being able to discuss their own mistakes. This is a human problem. For instance, as far as delay in diagnosis and referral is concerned, and the spiritual concerns of their patients and euthanasia. So two very current topics in the society as well as in the situation of palliative care patients. And facilitators are the willingness to talk about diagnosis and prognosis, the preparation for death, the patient's emotional, social, and spiritual issues, and the patient's end-of-life preferences. Once more, this is a palliative care study, so it has a specific aim, but it tells us quite a lot about the relationship between spiritual care and the entire doctor-patient relationship. The next keyword is Europe. Spiritual care works in Europe. Healthcare on the old continent, where we are now, has difficulties integrating spirituality. You can say we are the only continent in the world having this difficulty. The WHO definition is no problem in the Americas about spirituality, not in Africa, not in Asia. It's a problem basically in Europe and perhaps in Australia also. So philosophically, our tradition of enlightenment provokes a creative tension between religions, atheisms, naturalisms, and other spiritual orientations. It's not only a problem. It's our task to face this philosophical tradition and to foster discussions and rational discourse about spiritual care. The implementation has to be culturally sensitive, taking into account linguistic, religious, political, and social characteristics of countries, of cantons also, of regions and institutions. Here an example from Great Britain. All patients, carers receive support they desire within an integrated care approach. All health and social care professionals acknowledge issues of spiritual significance and respond in flexible, non-judgmental way. And spiritual needs of staff are recognized in palliative care. So this is also possible in Europe, but it's not admitted in all our European countries. Spiritual care should be proactive, so it should be an initiative of the healthcare professional, neutral in the sense of not making proselytism, no coercive, benevolent, respectful, non-intrusive, because the patient is a weak person, respectful of differences. Evidence-based medicine. Spiritual care works in the framework of evidence-based medicine. For instance, by evaluating health outcomes, health-related outcomes and costs in association with good or poor spiritual care. According to Kenneth Pagerman, spirituality may be part of the problem or part of the solution. So highly interesting outcomes are coping with illness, with dying, and quality of life, meaning-making, patients' satisfaction with healthcare. However, when it is true that spiritual care works in the framework of evidence-based medicine, it is also true that spiritual care does not fit in evidence-based medicine. It is true that certain spiritualities are problematic, for instance, coping entailing passivity and fatalism. Others are part of the solution. Nevertheless, I suppose there is no a priori knowledge about good or bad spiritualities. The patient is the main, the principal criterion about what is good and bad spirituality. Another Swiss example coming from Geneva. In Geneva, in spite of what I said about the political system, it is possible to make good research about spiritual care in psychiatry. And this group proposed several high-standard studies about spiritual assessment, taking a spiritual history in psychiatry. In a randomized controlled trial, they compared proactively taking a spiritual history versus reacting to the patient's desire. So in one case, I wait that the patient says, I want to speak about a spiritual topic. And in psychiatry, many patients are afraid when they, especially schizophrenic, when they speak about God, the doctor will put them in the crisis department or behind closed doors because he's speaking about God. This is not the case in cardiology. But in psychiatry, it may be dangerous to be a spiritual person because it is easily pathologized. So I'm glad about this study because it's from specialists of psychotic diseases, and they compare the proactive spiritual history. In other words, I, the psychiatrist, suggest we want to speak about spirituality. Tell me something about your beliefs and so on. It's like an invitation, but it's the doctor's initiative in one case, and in the other one, in the control group, it's the good standard. I wait that the patient will speak about God. And there is naturally an assessment training for psychiatrists before. So this study shows that patients wish to speak with their psychiatrists about religion and spirituality. Look at this baseline here. Here you have the spiritual assessment group, and here you have the control group. And of the assessment group, 26%, and in the control group, 30% want to speak about spirituality, so there is statistically no difference. And after the intervention, you have a significant difference that much more in the assessment group want to continue spiritual conversations with the doctors. So this is a nice study about taking a spiritual history, which may be a model also for other domains of clinical medicine. Now, a study I found it because Arndt Büssing was quoting it, this study of Balboni and Balboni in the Journal of Clinical Oncology. And now this is another study in the journal Cancer. It's about costs and spiritual care. So a large number of patients suffering from advanced cancer in a prospective multicentric study. And they compared, once more, patients satisfied with spiritual care with another group, not satisfied patients. And they compared the costs, intensive care, ventilation, and so on. I'm only showing you some of the results. You have in the yellow columns, you have the poor spiritual care providing, so patients not satisfied with spiritual care, and the blue ones, satisfied cancer patients. And you find large differences. So in the low spiritual support group, it's much more probable to go to the intensive care unit and to die also in intensive care unit than in the better spiritually accompanied group. And this is still more characteristic in the high religious coping patients. And the authors make a reflection about it, saying that the high religious coping very often have a fighting spirit inspired by their religious attitude. They want to do everything for surviving. And when this spiritual motivation is addressed in a spiritual interview, a spiritual dialogue, they may accept the change of therapeutic goal. They may accept, for instance, that continuing in palliative care is wiser than going to an intensive care unit or dying in an intensive care unit. But here you have the time of hospice care. So when a person is well accompanied, it is more probable that in the terminal phase, this person goes to the hospice. And here in cents and dollars, it's really expensive to make bad spiritual care. You should provide spiritual care. This is an argument for health economy. But I think it's impressionating the figures Balboni and colleagues are providing. So let's come to my last point, and then I hope to a discussion. Spiritual care works through discernment. The Christian tradition calls discernment of spirits the process of accompanying values, attitudes, actions, choices of a person. at a given point in time, we ignore the outcomes of a spiritual history. We see a person, we do not know how this spiritual history will continue. Even in palliative care, there may be an evolution. Finding or regaining a religious outlook on life during the long process of individuation is what we nowadays call the spiritual journey. And I come for finishing back to Carl Gustav Jung. He made a speech to pastors in Alsacia, and he said the following: among all my patients in the second half of life, that is to say over 35, there's not been one whose problem in the last resort was not that of finding a religious outlook of life on life. It is safe to say that every one of them fell ill because he had lost what the living religions of every age have given to their followers, and none of them has been really healed who did not regain his religious outlook. And of course, this religious outlook is quite independent and of denomination or church membership. So this last part is what nowadays we call spirituality, in contrast to institutionalized religiousness. So when you go outside, please have a look on our journal, Spiritual Care, not only for buying it, but also for writing something and for reading it. It's for all the health professions. You will find it at the bookstore. And if you want, come in October to Munich for, it's about 10 euro, but it's may also about 10 francs or 10 zloty or 10 crowns or pounds, or it's about economy and spirituality. Thank you very much for your attention. Harold, how do we progress now? Okay.
Yes, why don't we have questions now from the audience for Dr. Professor Frick.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Burgarella from Italy. I'm a cardiologist. I'm the founder of Telehealth, an association to promote the spiritual dimension in Italy. Just a simple word. What is the relationship between spiritual care and compassion?
Mm-hmm. I think it's a form of compassion, because we share as human beings the same openness, what we may call a transcendence, but we share it in a professional manner. So we will not impose what we have understood. We will listen to the patient, how he wants to cope with his illness and so on. So there's at the same time compassion and neutrality. I think it's very important in our European traditions, this neutrality of the doctor. But it should be, as you say, I think it's a good word, compassion in it.
Why the question? Mm-hmm. Because I think that compassion is a way that you could have and set up in your behavior with meditation. So if you are able to teach doctor to meditate, mm-hmm. you are able to set up compassion in the doctor. So you are able to bring them in the spiritual care too.
Yes, I'm convinced every spiritual care starts with the helper's spirituality. For instance, with mindfulness, meditation, being aware of the situation, and then you understand the aspirations of your patient.
Okay. Very broad views of the word spirituality, but especially I want to challenge the viewpoint that you should not utilize spirituality as mm-hmm. something that you should do for the benefits of it, mm-hmm. because of exactly the last word you mentioned, the mindfulness movement. I'm working with pain patients, and we put on mindfulness with the purpose of making less pain. That is why we put it on, and that's what we tell the patients also. It develops sometimes in some other strange directions, but it is for the utility of spirituality that we put on mm-hmm. the treatment. How yes. does mm-hmm. that go with your viewpoints in the start of the paper?
Yes, thank you, Peter. You have contributed quite a lot about understanding spirituality from your Scandinavian point of view, and what I did not address, the existential domain also. I think it's, it works with evidence-based therapy and medicine. For instance, mindfulness, meditation, but it goes beyond. And the danger is in instrumentalization is to restrict liberty, because spirituality means liberty, generosity. So basically, even in mindfulness, presence, which is the core of mindfulness, being present, is liberty. It's not. It has no purpose, being present. It's without intention. And according to your spiritual tradition, you may express it, for instance, in Zen. You meditate for meditating. You do not meditate for a Kensho experience, but you meditate for meditating. This is I admit it's paradoxical, but I don't know how to express it better. You're right, and. And I write also, but perhaps somebody may help us about this usefulness of spirituality and uselessness at the same time. There are two proposals.
Who's first? Ladies first.
I think maybe you could say that within spirituality there are methods or instruments that help get to a certain goal, and beyond them there's the transcendent, which is not to be reached by any of these, but needs them somehow, and it depends for what you use any of these instruments. For example, for reaching a state of less pain, and that's just an instrument for that goal. But then you can also have the aimlessness goal. Like, there's for maybe different levels.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yes?
What was the second one?
Hello. We know that spirituality and religion are very good for our patients, but a lot of techniques are still so alternative. Mm-hmm. I think that transpersonal psychology use holotropic breathing or 50s and 60s LSD therapy. Mm-hmm. It's very good for alcohol dependence treatment, and it's still very illegal and very alternative. And, mm-hmm. What do you think about alternative methods in spiritual care, transpersonal psychology methods? Thank you.
Your question is rather broad, so I do not want to... I cannot reply to the entire question. For instance, I'm not a specialist of complementary medicine. But what I want to say is the danger of an esoteric abuse of spirituality is attaining biomedical goals by other means in a kind of technique of forcing method. So you cannot reach, for instance, by oncology, radiation, radiotherapy, or by other methods, or by surgery, and you try to force it, what I call by an esoteric abuse of spirituality. And once more, in my opinion, spirituality is liberty. It's not forcing something. It's presence, and this may be useful, maybe it may give relief, for instance, for a pain patient. But it's not another drug. It's beyond our categories of therapeutic efficiency. Transpersonal, maybe you can give a more clear-cut question, because I do not know what I could say about transpersonal psychology, or maybe there is a specialist of it in the audience. It's a part of an answer what I said, or if not, you react and.
I know methods and holotropic breathing, yes. And there are still different therapies. Stanislav Grof is one,
yes.
Author, and.
Yes.
There's different dancing and more transcendating treatment systems, but it's
yes.
Still alternative.
I gave you a general criterion, which is liberty and not esoteric abuse of therapeutic power. But I'm also convinced that in transpersonal psychology there are quite a lot of true healing processes. So I do not want to blame a method which I do not know very, very well.
Thank you for a very interesting lecture. In Norway, where I come from, the chaplains in the hospitals there are employed by the hospitals. Mm-hmm. And there's a little conflict going on regarding the rationality of why are the chaplains there? Mm-hmm. And the chaplains themselves are more and more concerned about that. They're thinking more and more that in the ways that they are healthcare providers and experts on the spiritual care and existential issues and so on, and religion. While many... especially in the hospitals, who are running the hospitals, they think that they are sort of sent from the church and are priests in a more genuine understanding of that. And both these aspects are coming together, of course. Mm-hmm. You said something about it, but do you think is it a conflict going on in Europe regarding these things?
Yes, it's.
What is the identity of the of the chaplain in a modern hospital?
Yes, it is a conflict, and it's important to discuss about it also theologically. I quoted Isolde Carle, and I can quote also the Canadian theologian Guy Jobin, who wrote about the appropriation of spirituality by the health professions. So he studied manuals of nursing science, of medicine, of social work and psychology, looking at the use and abuse of spirituality by the health professionals. From this theological point of view, what is important is the critical function of belief, of theology, in the framework of medicine. When you integrate it completely, you lose this critical point of view. So it's theologically, it's important, I think, to be in this world, but not to be, theologically speaking, of this world. So to make a distinction. And this is not yet, we don't have a solution for this. We have countries as Belgium, for instance, and the Netherlands also, but I think they are specialists in the audience. Hermann, you could say something about the Dutch situation and how, as a theologian, you reflect about the evolution in the healthcare system and chaplaincy.
Dutch specialists also, but in short, I think there is a clear shift in the Netherlands from let's say the spiritual care in institutions from denominational perspective to professionalization, meaning that the spiritual caretaker is now no longer in service of a congregation or a religious community, but as in Norway, appointed by a secular institution, like a hospital or a mental institution, which also means that, given the fact that there are now spiritual care master programs, that not only theologians can become spiritual caretakers, but also people who have studied religious studies,
yes,
and who are no longer theologians, but quasi work as if they were chaplains in a secular institution, which is a kind of a strange situation, but this is a rough sketch. I think it is, I'm quite right here at the moment. This is actually the situation at the moment.
Yes, because the imams are not as integrated to healthcare as Christian chaplains are, probably are.
We simply need them to help us to understand the patients.
Yes, of course.
Anyway, we do not totally understand them, but due to their help, the care appears to be a bit better dressed.
Mm-hmm. Let me repeat my proposal of terms. I would like to reserve spiritual care to the health professions in general. So the chaplains may be considered as a part of a healthcare system, but not entirely. Because for me, a chaplain, pastoral carer, is somebody sent by his religious congregation. And spiritual care is, roughly speaking, a health professional category now, a shared, a teamwork. This was my theme, how does it work? I know that, for instance, in Dutch, you told me geestelijke verzorging is an equivalent of spiritual care, and also in Quebec, soins spirituels, it's a translation of spiritual care to French. So the terms also are a little bit vague, and I try to reserve spiritual care to health professions, and pastoral care, chaplaincy, to to what are religious congregations, Judaism, Islam, Christianism, basically. But I admit that this is not accepted by everybody because it's an ongoing semantic shift and we do not know where it will arrive eventually. But we need reflection about it. Let me say a last thing. When I discuss with theologians, very often there's also a problem of what is Berufspolitik in English? Professional identity and professional interests. Lobbying. There's also a problem of lobbying. So some chaplains are afraid of spiritual care because they are afraid we will lose our jobs. Yes. Or churches are afraid because they say, what do those physicians plan? They will make a revolution in healthcare and pastoral care and so on. And I think those lobbying is nothing criminal, it's entirely legal. But we should not mix up this lobbying point with a theological reflection and a rational discourse about spiritual care. We should declare now there are professional interests touched. Okay, it's not a sin. But we should not make a rationalization of professional interests by theology. That is my point. And for spiritual care in medicine, it's clearly the interest of the patient, which is the main criterion, and not the influence of a religion or a congregation.
Maybe I can add something from a theological point of view. I think that spiritual care in the broader sense that Eckhart has introduced it is a challenge to pastoral care. Mm-hmm. It challenges pastoral care workers to be clearer about their mission. What is the mission of pastoral care within the healthcare system? They have to be clearer about their own professional understanding, their self-understanding. Are we pastoral psychotherapists, as many of us were trained to be, or are we priests, as the church sends some of us into the field? We have to be clearer about our own understanding of our own role. Are we only sent to the patient, or are we part of a whole system? And spiritual care is an approach that says you're part of a system, but as part of a system, you have to be pretty clear about how are you working. You have to be transparent about how many people do you see. Do you document, do you communicate some of the information that you gather from patients? So there's a lot of standards that are suddenly open for discussion beyond the borders of church or beyond the borders of your own profession. So we have it's a challenge, and we will come out different from what we are or what we have been before.